through my work on climate change and food, that is really what the World Food Prize put shone this, you know, and it continues to shine this very bright spotlight on climate change and food. The food system is responsible for 30% of the total human-caused greenhouse gases. It's amazingly big.
This is One on One, a Table for Two production. I am Antoine Aboussamra.
I really was part of the group of scientists who were asking not just the what if question of what would happen to the climate, but the so what questions of why do we care? The impacts researchers that I'm really part of, it's what's happening to the water resources, what's happening to the forests, what's happening to the ecology, and what's happening to the food.
In every episode, I invite you to hear the stories of people in the world of food who are on a mission to protect the environment, defend their cultures, or fight for more social and economic justice. One on One will help you see the world in a different way.
Listen, it's not only that climate change is happening, climate change solutions and actions are happening. There's just tremendous uptake.
Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be back for a new episode of the One on One podcast. And today is a very, very, very special one because we have the honor, privilege, and pleasure to welcome Dr. Cynthia Rosenzweig. She's the World Food Prize laureate for 2022. I was going to say it's the Oscars of food agriculture, but they say it's a Nobel Prize, you know, for scientists. Good afternoon, Cynthia.
Good afternoon, Antoine.
Shortly, as a bit of background, so you're a senior research scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, which is co-located at Columbia with the Climate School as well, where you are also part of the faculty. You are also a senior researcher, and one of the things that is very specific about your experience is that you were one of the first ones, if not the first one, to model basically the impact of climate on agriculture and on land. There was a paper in 1985. It was the first paper that you wrote on that. And at the time, you were a trainee, an intern at the Goddard Space Institute for Space Studies. And there was a question that came down from that back then director, Jim Hansen. That was what happens to food, basically. You know, what will happen to food? So this is how it started.
That's correct. Jim Hansen, who was my longtime boss, director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, was originally from Iowa. I think this might be why he asked this question. He was on the top floor of our institute. I was in the lowly, almost basement. And this question came filtering down based on really some of the early projections of the global climate model, which was developed at our institute, which was projecting the climate effects all over the world of increasing greenhouse gases. So there was the climate projections. Mm-hmm. There were the climate projections, but Jim asked the question, what will happen to food? The question came trickling down to the almost basement where my office was, with a window on the air shaft, you know, in New York City. The buildings, some of them don't have windows to the street. And I was there, and I had my master's in agronomy, soils and crops, from Rutgers, and was working on remote sensing of agricultural scenes there at the NASA Institute, Research Institute. But this question was really I was the only person there who could begin to answer that question. So what I say is I began to answer Jim's question about how climate change would affect food, and I've basically been answering it ever since.
Yeah. So you were an agronomist, and there's a love of food. There is a love of agriculture that has come. If I understand correctly, there's a place called Valia.
Yes.
That has been very important in your development. Can you tell us a bit more about this wonderful place?
Yes. So, I really fell in love with agriculture. So that the story with Jim Hansen is really how I started working on the interactions of climate change and food. But even before that, my love of agriculture, even before I studied agronomy, was that my husband-to-be and I went to live in the country outside of Florence, in Tuscany. And we were very, very fortunate to have live in one of those farmhouses. People might have seen the pictures of them. They have red tile roofs.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Kind of this like dull, this brown color. And we rented one of those, and our neighbors came and taught us how to do the agriculture, the farming from that farmhouse.
That's beautiful.
When I fell in love with agriculture.
It's a beautiful life, good food, good producers. You know where it comes from.
Oh my gosh, absolutely the best.
Do you miss that?
Yes, I do. I do. And in fact, our family, now we're doing it. They're sort of our kids are helping us get back every 5 years for a stay in Tuscany to get all together now with the family. And so, yes, but all during COVID, of course, we missed it terribly. So yes, we have a very strong connection still.
Because that connection to the land, that connection to the soil that nurtures us at the end of the day is so important. When you started your studies, and did you always wanted to do something for that, to keep that, you know, that way of living, to keep that way of growing things?
Right. Yes, I think so. And also the interaction with climate came very early in my studies. I studied a Middle Eastern, a clover. It's called subterranean clover. It's from the Middle East originally. And it can survive because it puts its seed heads down in the soil. It can survive cool temperatures. And so for my master's thesis, I did a study on sub-clover, it's called, to see what the climate connections, in that case, it was because it's colder environment here. But just fast forwarding, then when I got started with the modeling of climate and food and crop interactions, and founded AgMIP, which I'm sure we're going to get to in a moment.
Yes, definitely.
Interplay with being still connected to the land, the actual growing and what it really takes. And I continue to be in utter awe of farmers who interact with the land year in and year out, season by season. But then with the science, we do the modeling, right, which is an abstraction of that, right? So I'm going to tell a story about AgMIP now. We hold workshops, AgMIP before COVID, and we hope to get back to them, hold workshops all over the world with agricultural researchers and modelers. And we would have 5 days, and because there's so much work with the coding and then the scenarios and the climate data and the ag data, et cetera, and soil data, but I would insist that in the 5 days we had to stop doing the computer work, and that we have to go to the field and see the agriculture. So in South Africa and Tanzania and all around the world, in Brazil, everywhere. So I'm bringing the modelers to, I insisted on making sure that the modelers also were connected to the land.
Yeah, it's so very important to actually see what they're studying on.
Exactly.
Because math is and modeling can be fascinating, but there's a connection to reality.
Exactly.
Talking about connection, There was two things I was wondering is how come that relationship between, you know, climate and food came at that time and not before? It was just like it's because food is you know so important for our lives. Without it, we're not there. You think it was the right time? It was a bit late. There may be reasons for that. People were not aware, or they didn't really think about that.
That is a really, really good question. There was so much emphasis for so long in the climate change issue just on the climate.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was part of was, I really was part of the group of scientists who were asking not just the what if question of what mm-hmm. would happen to the climate, but the so what questions of why do we care? Why do we care about climate change?
Mm-hmm.
If it didn't affect every single thing on the planet, it would just be, oh, the climate is changing, right? But that's why, but in the impacts researchers that I'm really part of, it's what's happening to the water resources, what's mm-hmm. happening to the forests, what's happened to the ecology, and what's happening to the food. So it took a while for but Jim's question was prescient, so so that's when I was able to get started very early on the so what, answering the so what question of climate impacts.
Yeah, and there was also extremely interesting is that the work that you've been doing, you cannot do it in isolation, as you were mentioning right now. There's so many different things that are interrelated, that are connected, that are so complex, that is not just, let's say, climatologists that would understand everything, or agronomists that would understand everything. There has to be that cooperation and that collaboration. How complicated was it at the beginning? Because now people take it for granted in a way that people are working together. But back then, when you started working on those issues, how complicated was it to get people at the table and
yes.
starting to work together?
Yes, right. So the crop modelers at that time were grouped into tribes because there were different crop models that were developed, and then there were kind of a tribe of people who used that model, and then there were other tribes who had developed other models.
Ooh.
And frankly, the tribes, there was like intertribal warfare. It's like, we have the best model. No, we have the best model. No, we have the best model. So what I say is both the models and the modelers were finally mature enough to actually then come together. And that's really a lot, you know, then what really my work involves is bringing the researchers together and designing the protocol-based assessments so that the rigor of the science is strengthened, so that then we then, when we take our results to policymakers and the UNFCCC Framework Convention on Climate Change process, we are, just as the climate scientists have been doing for years, we then now are doing that for, in our case, agriculture and food.
Yeah. As we're moving forward in time, there was a moment that was very interesting where there was that connection that was made. I think it was 2008, where the connection between the what they call anthropogenic climate change, which is basically the result of human actions, okay, on climate, and that it was basically the cause of that climate change that has an impact on biological and physical aspects of the world. How sure were you at the time when you published that? Was it something that you realized that, okay, when you say with certainty, you know, how was it a surprise, or it was just a way of actually, okay, you saw the numbers, but you needed to make sure that there was that link, that connection between what we did as human beings and the impact on the climate?
Yes. So this is the research area that I brought to the IPCC, which is called Detection and Attribution of Climate Change Impacts. So It's complicated because on any of our impact sectors, but here we're talking about agriculture and food, there are many stresses on, there are many things that affect, let's say just very simply, crop yields in any one agricultural region around the world. And what we began there, and now new work, we're involved in great new work continuing this, is to really, you see, everything that happens, let's say, to crop yields, not necessarily climate change. So one of the areas that we work on in science is to understand it in, let's say, yield trends that are negative in some places, or extreme events. For example, in France, the very, very high temperature that also had tremendous heat stress effect and mortality, but also affected the crops at the same time. And so what we do is we analyze the trends in the crop yields and what happened, and link them to the climate. And then an additional piece of it is the greenhouse gas emissions, right, that is then affecting the climate, it's then that affects the crop yields. But it's not, you can never say one-to-one. It's we're analyzing how much is climate change, how much is just natural climate variability, how much is what perhaps there was a policy that year that then from the governments. So that's what we do. That's one of the areas that we work on in science, okay, and, of climate change impacts.
Because of the complexity and the way to communicate that complexity to the audience, to the mainstream people, to people across the world, isn't that because it's complex that it's hard to explain, and that some people are exploiting that difficulty to bring out ideas that are much more easily understandable but not necessarily true? And this is why you get a lot of misinformation, disinformation. Isn't that an issue in terms of the communication of that complexity?
Well, I would say also certainly more in the beginning. Right now we're in, a different place, because the climate trends and the increasing frequency and duration of climate extremes around the world have now then led to, most everyone understands, I mean, it's, they've experienced climate change themselves. So there's, I think fundamentally, there's been a real shift in acceptance of the issue. But back in the beginning, when climate change was just getting going, I mean, lately now we've been seeing this much stronger effects, right? But in the beginning, it was really challenging, I think, for the scientists to communicate that based on rigorous science, this is what's really going on, because it is so challenging to our civilization, which is based on the use of energy, right? And this is really climate change, not all of it, but a great deal of it is linked in regards to greenhouse gas emissions to sources from burning of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
So there was, I think, this opportunity in the beginning for these kinds of real bringing from different points of view about climate change. But I do feel, and I wonder if you do too, I mean, right, really in the past, like, let's say 5 years, with so many climate extremes happening around the world, affecting food supplies, affecting all the different impact sectors, coastal flooding, some migration has some climate change, like drought in Syria, for example, in the Middle East. Again, it's not a one-on-one. It's not that climate change caused every single person to leave Syria, who did, but it's a contributing factor. And my feeling from having lived through all of this in my working career and my research career, that right now there's much greater acceptance of the issue. And I hope that I hope less misinformation. I think so.
It's very important, because you realize I've seen the change in the weather pattern from the 80s compared to now, for instance. There are things that are, you know, that doesn't make sense anymore.
It's undeniable, really.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
See, there were climate deniers,
yes.
You know, and, you know, we, which definitely were there, denying the climate change. And the role of human beings, that's really what I think the real argument was about.
Yes. Yeah, it's not
but
us.
now there aren't really climate deniers or any more climate change deniers. There may be a few here and there, but many fewer.
Yeah, much less. The impact on our lives is definite. And the work that you do on a constant basis is to bring those information and those models to the decision makers. So you've been involved in the IPCC report of 2019 on climate change and land. So this is something that is right what you're working on. And as in parallel, in 2008, so it was before that, you started AGMIP. So it's an acronym. You love acronyms, huh? You scientists, there's something,
yeah, right,
something
right.
With acronyms.
We're growing acronyms. It's our product. No, I'm just kidding.
So what does AGMIP?
Okay. AGMIP stands for Agricultural Model Intercomparison and Improvement Project. The I stands for two things.
Okay.
So we compare the models. So we brought the tribes together. That's really what AGMIP did. It brought these crop modeling tribes together. Everybody and the models were finally ready to be able to rigorously all do protocol-based assessments of the climate change, so that we are able to be, when we bring the results to the policymakers, we're able to, it's on a much stronger scientific foundation.
Yes.
So that's really what AGMIP, that's one whole part of AGMIP. It's that's the intercomparison part.
Yeah.
But the other part mm-hmm. of the I stands for improvement, because we can't just keep using the same models over and over. We're constantly learning, constantly getting, interacting with our colleagues who do the field experiments, getting those data and bringing those data and more processes like right into the models, so that as we go along, so that when we do the next assessment and our work goes mm-hmm. really cool, really kind of like highway to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment mm-hmm. reports, that it's always with the latest and greatest, so that we're really using the best science at all times. Right now we're working with nutrition specialists mm-hmm. to bring more nutrition into the models. There was just yield, but now we know that the carbon dioxide, while on the one hand it helps to boost yields in some crops and regions, but at the same time, the high CO2 has effects on the protein quality and the micronutrients in crops. Mm-hmm. So we're now bringing those into the crop models so that we can have a much more fuller picture of what the actual effects will be.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, as you're saying, having nutritious food, healthy food, is also very important. It's not just about, calories. It's different. A dinner at a trattoria in Firenze is one thing, and a meal at McDonald's is a different
exactly.
one.
Even though I know McDonald's and all that, they're trying. So yes. Yeah, so
but in terms of nutrition quality, it's different.
Totally, yes. And this nutrition quality for all is we're now really bringing, because there's a whole group of nutrition experts who work on just the nutrition part of food. You may have had mm-hmm. them on one-on-one podcasts
not
with
yet.
You
not yet.
And oh well, I can hook you up to
oh
some
that,
wonderful-
I would love to.
Yes, oh yes. So you see, there's, it's almost kind of a parallel effort. So there's the climate change and the countries of the world getting together and putting forward their nationally determined contributions to solving climate change. And then the nutrition experts are doing something similar in getting countries to agree to targets to improve the nutrition of their citizens. And one of the efforts that we're doing is trying to bring those two groups and two efforts together.
Well, that's wonderful. We're going to come back on the science part, but there's something I wanted to touch upon, because you were talking about the impact you wanted to have on the policymakers. So you look at the science, you do those complicated research and try to understand what is happening, and then you bring this to the policymakers. Copenhagen was a bit of a wake-up call, if I understand correctly. There was a realization that maybe to change at the country level, it's complicated. So there was a direction towards cities. Can you tell us a bit more about that support for the cities and what they're trying to
yes,
do?
Yes, sure. Our institute is located in Manhattan, mm-hmm. New York City. And I'm from the New York metropolitan region. And parallel to our work with agriculture and food, with my work with agriculture and food, I also started with urban specialists' work on climate change and cities. And what we came to realize is that the cities are at the right level to do so much on climate change solutions. Mm-hmm. Cities themselves are responsible, depending on how you count, of course, but they're responsible for up to 70% of greenhouse gas emissions in their processes, transportation, manufacturing, et cetera. And at the same time, they're on the front lines, all the cities on the coast, as Beirut is, sea level rise, coastal flooding, as sea level rises, the storm of the same strength goes further inland on the flooding. And then the heat stress, the vulnerability of the populations, of the lower income mm-hmm. populations. Mm-hmm. And we realize that the cities can play this important role. And yes, so when at the Copenhagen Conference of the Parties, the countries had a very hard time coming to any agreements. They couldn't come to the agreement that finally happened in Paris in 2015. But the cities, we participated in the cities. They were driving electric cars around the main square. The mayors drove over and to the university, and we had this wonderful interaction. So and by the way, just linking to food, urban areas are where the consumers are.
Mm-hmm,
so sure. It's really important to include, and this leads to something on the food system approach beyond agriculture. What's really the field is now going to food system. So it's not just the supply side, it's also the demand mm-hmm. side. And in when you look at the demand side, you have to take cities into account in the food for the food in the food system.
Have you seen changes?
Yes, definitely. It's amazing. I wanted to ask you too if you've seen them in Beirut. But for example, we just gave this. We did a class at the Columbia School for International Public Affairs, SIPA School, and we were talking to them. They mainly work on energy, mm-hmm. but food is responsible. By the way, food system emissions. The food system is responsible for 30% of the total human-caused greenhouse gases. Yeah. It's amazingly big.
It's big.
It really is. It's huge. So that's when you take the energy to make the fertilizers, the energy to make the tractors, right? The clearing of the land, the draining of the peat land, then the on-farm, all the on-farm energy use,
yes.
plus rice, plus beef cattle,
yes.
plus all
yes.
of that, right? And then all the emissions on the supply chain, all the transportation, right? And then, of course, there's food loss and waste all along.
Yes.
So it's really huge, really huge player. But back to the emissions from the, so the cities mm-hmm. really need to be involved as well on both sides.
So the changes have happened, every day we get news and sometimes they're not very good. How do you keep motivated? How do you keep hopeful? Because it doesn't, when you look at, you know, the last COP in Sharm el Sheikh, as an audience, I would say I'm not super excited about the results, not seeing the big changes happening. How do you keep motivated to keep on, you know, pressing the issue and coming further with, you know, more refined models and talking to the decision makers and the policy makers and the scientific community about, you know, things are happening.
Yes.
How do you keep that motivation?
Yeah. I'm so fortunate because I interact with so many groups. Remember you said in the beginning about bringing the groups together and interacting and working together. And because I'm just been so fortunate to be able to interact with so many groups around the world, it's not only that climate change is happening, climate change solutions and actions are happening. Yeah. There's just tremendous uptake. And I think there's a thing with the media. I know you're interested in the media representation of climate change and its impacts and its solutions. And, you know, solutions are good news. But, you know, the media is much more driven by bad news.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to see how people are actually dealing with those issues and how they're fighting at their level. Because I have a belief that if we wait for the, you know, the news or the decision to come from high up, we can wait for a long time.
Exactly. That's when I flew home on the plane after Copenhagen, I had that realization. It's like, we can't wait anymore for the countries. They did finally catch up with the Paris Agreement, and they're working hard, and, you know, loss and damage came with the, you know, Sharm el Sheikh and COP27.
Yes.
The loss and damage was extremely important. But, you know, it took years of pushing.
And it's got to be implemented.
Yes, that's true. That's true, very much. But I was on a call this morning with the World Adaptation. I'm part of the World Adaptation Science Program. It comes out of seven UN funding climate change action funding agencies. And we're going to be standing up a research program, a core project on implementation of adaptation, for example. So a research program on loss and damage. Yeah. So specifically. So you know, it again, you see things are happening that often aren't represented, I think. And look, when you go to I don't know if you've been to the COP, if you were in Sharm el Sheikh. I didn't go this year. I've been to several of them, or many. And, you know, I liken them to medieval fairs or trade shows for climate change. And when you actually go and experience it, so let's go, you know, let's meet in Dubai, because food, by the way, for the 28th, food is going to be very front and center in Dubai. And you'll see, there are like 50,000 people all coming with their groups, their work, what they're doing, their solutions. And you come away much more encouraged than you would if you just read the media about what happened with the country negotiations.
Yes, because there is always, you know, they pick and choose what can, you know, what can attract the audience in a way.
That's right. But this tremendous bottom up. Oh, and the young people, and, you know, it's just wonderful. Really. It's an experience. It's a life. I tell my people in my group who go, you know, we work on trading around to see who's going to go. And it's an experience of a lifetime.
A lot of energy. People are trying to save the planet at the end of the day.
Exactly. And you really feel it.
And especially there's a lot of activists now that are taking... What is the relationship? What kind of relationship exists between scientists and activists? Are there bridges between the two, or are there like two separate tribes?
Well, definitely I would say, I would say tribes, different tribes. It's just different roles in society, mm-hmm. right? But the way I describe it is, for scientists, there's a individual scientists as individuals. There's a spectrum of engagement with activism. Some people, like Jim Hansen, mm-hmm. very much as he went along in his career, he became both he's a fantastic mm-hmm. scientist and an activist. Others are much more just on the other end. I just want to do my science. Sorry, no, I'm not interacting. And every scientist is finding their place on that spectrum of the interaction with mm-hmm. the activism.
Because it's complicated in a sense, because, you know, there's the scientific rigor of the research and everything like right. that. But it is related yeah. to natural causes, natural things, you know, life in general. So you cannot be, as you were saying, when you go to those seminars across the world over the 5 days, you take the people to the land to show them, okay, this is exactly. how a potato is grown. This is how things are coming out of the soil.
Yes, very much so. And also then effects of recent climate extremes. Just yes, on a call yesterday, you know, a colleague was sharing about the issues in Mozambique right now, mm-hmm. you know, the Horn of Africa, mm-hmm. East Africa. It's just happening now, and those climate and food connections. So yes, keeping you know, our feet on the ground. Our feet in the fields, yeah. maybe, is what I feel is also very, very important.
Yeah, we're getting close to the end of the conversation. I was going to go on for hours, but I have a couple of more questions before we go to the people questionnaire. When we talk about the World Food Prize, so, you know, the Nobel of Food and Agriculture, the Nobel Prize for Food and Agriculture, what does it mean to receive such a prize and such a distinction, because you've been working in climate change for a very long time. How does it feel?
It's just a tremendous, first of all, a surprise. I'll never forget when it was a Zoom call, because it was during COVID, right? It was a Zoom call, and it was really unexpected. And I just continue to be, and always will be, the thrill and honor of it will never go away.
Oh, that's wonderful. And have you seen changes afterwards when people are talking about those issues about climate change after the World Food Prize, and people are saying, oh, this is interesting, let's talk about this, let's look into it. Has it changed something?
Oh, yes, very much so. You see, it shines this just very bright spotlight on the work of, first of all, on the really the challenges of climate change and food. Because through my work on climate change and food, that is really what the World Food Prize put shone this, you know, and it mm-hmm. continues to shine this very bright spotlight on climate change and food. Then really specifically, it also shined a great spotlight on AgMIP. And so people now, many, many more people around the world know about AgMIP and what we do. And we've, have been able, you know, so wonderful new projects, new partnerships. Also, you know, I've just interacted with so many groups around the world. I'll just share one that's really arising directly mm-hmm. from the food prize activities. Is a project. It's being led out of the U.S. State Department, and it's on a vision for adapting soils and crops in Africa, and not just the big four crops, you know, wheat, maize, soybean, and rice, right? But the traditional crops. They just gave us this list, 150 crops. So we have to now make models up for them. We need a lot of data. So we're working with the with the breeders, we're working with the nutritionists and the models, bringing them together really in new ways to be able to really make sure that we have the genetic diversity to have resilience in the food security of Africa, in this case, the seed supplies, mm-hmm. which crops really seem to be will be the most resilient, the most nutritious, right? Which have the seed there in this, you know, in the seed bank, so that they can be, the diversity can mm-hmm. be saved and spread and generated, and the seeds generated and proliferated. Yeah. So it's a very exciting project that came directly from the prize.
Wow, that's fascinating. I was talking to one of the researchers at Grain, which is an NGO that supports small farmers, and it was Devlin Kuyak was telling me that Western Africa is one of the places where they have some of the most nutritious crops, cassava being part of these, and et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to see how the local farmers were basically, you know, taking care of the families and everything because of the local crops that they were, right, you know, growing. Biodiversity, yes, is super important. And what is very interesting in what you're saying is that maybe years ago, decades ago, that approach to biodiversity or regenerative and things like that, or nutritious food, was not on the map.
No.
It was not. It was,
no,
like it's, no, produced.
Right. And now we hope a beginning of a very large effort to raise up those crops, and many, many more of them, and the nutritious crops that have been, sometimes they're called neglected crops or orphan crops, but really now we want to get them into families. Wow. So they won't be orphans anymore.
Oh, that would be wonderful. One last question before the pivot questionnaire. When you look back, 85, and you see now, would you have expected the path that you would have taken?
You know, I think in everyone's life, you know, there are real, the path isn't straight.
Yeah.
Right. There's always cul-de-sacs and you know, different parts along the way. So I don't think I could foresee. And what I really couldn't foresee was the farm in Italy, from the farm in Italy, you know, with the chickens and the goats and, you know, picking the grapes and the olives and all of that, with our wonderful, wonderful neighbors, who really taught us how to do everything. That, and then coming all the way to the World Food Prize. That's the real amazing, amazing journey. In some ways, the science has this, see, with science, what you do is you do one, and then you do one part. And so I did that first paper that was on where the wheat regions mm-hmm. would move in North America, because they're linked to the bioclimatic envelopes for the different types of wheat, red wheat and soft and hard mm-hmm. and all of that, and durum and cakes and bread, you know, different flours,
depending on the season,
for different,
yes.
Exactly, for different varieties and parts of the species. But then I sent a memo to Jim Hansen, and I said, look, what we need to do is we need to do the models. We need to bring the models into this. That was a different kind of model, expert system model or agroecological zone model. But what we need to do is do this dynamic, these dynamic process models, kind of like the climate models, but for the crops, that then, because we have the CO2 effects coming in, that's positive on the yields, not so much on these other nutrients, but and then we have to have the climate effects on the soil, mm-hmm. you know, at the rooting and all this. So that was the next step, and then we did the next step. Well, now we need to, let's bring in the water, let's have a project with, okay, the water resources, and then how did the climate affect that? So you see how it's really a step by step that you can actually see from that very first 1985 paper, how each step is like, and the next question. That's what's so great about being a research scientist, but that's the way it really works.
You have an idea what the next question is?
Yes, very much. always. When we look at AgMIP, and there's more than one question.
Yeah.
Because we have about 25 or 30 different teams who work on improving the models for evapotranspiration, the water part. We're doing machine learning. Mm-hmm. What do we learn from machine learning? How do we put in, we have to put in much better job on frost, much better job on flooding, and this nutrition, very, very key parts on nutrition, expanding the number of crops. So these are all, we call it the petal diagram of AgMIP, all of the things which are the next questions.
Wow. Looking forward to the next steps, definitely. As I said, unfortunately, we're getting close to the end. As I say, I could talk for hours. This is absolutely fascinating. But before ending, on a lighter note, the pivot questionnaire. So it's the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, what's your favorite word?
Energy. I think you can see that. By the way, I think you can see that now. Now we've met each other. I think you can see why energy is my favorite word.
Yes. What is your least favorite word?
Hate.
Mm-hmm. Your favorite virtue?
Loyalty.
Your favorite quality in a woman?
So it's the same for the woman and the man.
Well, fair enough.
Non-defensiveness. To bring people together and work together, we have to be non-defensive. Everybody.
Wow. It's the first time that someone says, because you have heard many. This is beautiful. So for the next one, so what wine or dish or ingredient or staple or produce would you use to describe yourself?
Your choice. I would say ratatouille. I'll tell you why. It's Mediterranean.
Yes.
It's a Mediterranean dish. Yes. And you know, my roots are in the Mediterranean, my agriculture roots. It's vegetarian.
Yes.
So, you know, we need to be focusing more on vegetarian,
yes,
you know, less on meat consumption, and just this wonderful mélange of all the ingredients. That's my favorite. And I think that describes the work actually also as well.
Oh yeah, I second that. Yeah. What's your favorite curse word?
Okay, so this one is really, really hard because I don't curse. I come from a very, very kind of strict Presbyterian background. And this was really like, you know, it's one of the Ten Commandments.
Yes.
It was one of the Ten Commandments.
Okay. So
I just don't have them in my vocabulary.
Okay. So forget the curse word. When you're upset in traffic, you're upset. What do you say?
I guess the far as I would go would be to say, darn it.
Well, fair enough. Nice.
Darn.
Okay. Darn is great. What sound or noise do you love?
So this is relating to AgMyth and what you were saying about bringing groups together. So in our very, very first meeting in which we brought modelers and agricultural modelers from all over the world, and we still do this at our AgMyth Global Workshops, and you're invited to our Global 9-1. It's the last week in June in New York. We want to get you to New York. At lunchtime, we asked people to eat lunch at tables for their continent.
Oh.
And so when you look out across the room, the dining room, where we're eating, it's a living map. And what you can hear is the noise. This is my favorite sound. So then the South Americans are speaking Spanish and Portuguese,
yeah,
right? The Europeans are like, you know, French and German, or, you know, of course, English is the, you know, our common lingua franca.
Yeah.
But it's just the sound of the living map is my favorite sound.
Wow. Nice. That's a first as well. I had the birds and I had the sea. What sound or noise do you hate?
Yes, so this one, it's hard. So I'm a grandmother now. You can see
congrats.
From my gray hair. So, which is such a wonderful, wonderful experience. But also, I think in a way, this linkage of the food and then cooking for the grandchildren, you know, and being with the grandchildren. But when they're in pain, it's so hard for the grandparents. So I would say a grandchild in pain, the noise, the sounds that they make. That's the one I really, really don't like.
What plant or animal would you like to be reincarnated in?
So I just learned about a new crop from West Africa. You may have heard about it from your interviewee from Grain. It's called Fonio. And there's a wonderful chef whom I'm not sure, maybe you've had Chef Pierre on.
No. Is it from Senegal?
Yes. He's from Senegal, I believe, and I think Fonio is grown there. It's like a millet, and we did this wonderful Bill Gates event. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it's on the Goalkeepers event from Climate Week in New York.
Yeah.
And he did a cooking demonstration, and it was with two colleagues from Africa. Lindiwe Simbanda was one of them, or three of us, but it was Lindiwe and me and Bill Gates. And we all made a Fonio salad together.
Ooh, nice.
And so Fonio is my new thing.
Okay. And last question, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear say God when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Okay, this is it. I would like to hear, how's AgMIP going?
Dr. Cynthia Rosenzweig, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Antoine. Wonderful.